Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for November the 18th, 2018. Yes, the beginning of Thanksgiving week. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we go from City Hall to the State House and all the way out to the White House. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your holiday week off to a great start. Well, it's great to have Dave and Andy back in studio this
back
week after
at the old homestead.
Did you get me any gifts out there at tree time last week?
It's too early to say that.
No. I wanted to bring you the apple that was shot off of Swanee's head there, but it disappeared. Yeah.
The remnants would have been nice.
Yeah,
you know,
applesauce.
Applesauce, yes. And some put that into an apple pie.
Or Dave Schwann's special apple cider.
Ooh, there you go.
Hard apple cider there.
Swanee cider. I like that.
He could have used it if it was actually him standing there.
Yeah, I'm sure. No, a great show, guys. Great show. But great to have you back in-house today.
Good to be back.
You know, I wanted, Andy, you to note especially. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
I'm wearing my orange Urlacher.
You got the orange
jersey.
On. They're wearing orange tonight, I believe.
And in my Bears hat. And I have to admit, I did get dressed in the dark, so I have a purple shirt on.
So Northwestern, it's all good.
Well, I'm actually saying it's an homage to my parent side of the family up from Minnesota.
Ah, okay, I gotcha.
But yeah, I would not have picked purple.
That's okay.
But nothing against the Cats, believe me. But yeah, so what are we looking for in this game tonight?
Well, this is going to be a real test. This is going to be the first real test that this team has faced all year. You know, they've beaten some teams that they probably should have beaten. They've lost to some teams that they should have beaten. But, you know, the Vikings defense is really good. It's a very good and underrated defense as well. Bears won three straight home game. I want to see what Mitch Trubisky does now under the spotlight of this home game on Sunday night. It's not, the same kind of feeling as he had when they were in Green Bay.
Right.
Because you don't have that opportunity to script 15 plays, through a whole thing of training camp. And there's nothing on tape that the Vikings haven't seen him do. So it's going to be interesting to see how he handles it. I'm looking towards him at first, but I think that any mistakes he make can be quickly erased by Khalil Mack.
That's what I'm counting on, the Bears' defense.
Kirk Cousins is nothing really to write home about.
No, and I don't see that their offensive line is all that strong.
Very true. And if that's the case, it's going to be a long, long night for Mr. Cousins.
Well, let's hope so.
I agree.
It's the first place Bears, and it gives me something to avert my eyes to instead of my Blackhawks.
Yeah,
Wow.
I think you can kind of excuse it at this point just because it's the crossover of the two systems. You know, you're trying to unlearn, if
right.
That's a word. You're trying to unlearn the Q system, and you're now trying to get the Colleton system under your belt. Which is, you know, a little bit different, especially defensively. I'm not really sure what to make of this because it's the same players, and it's just either a bunch of bad puck luck, like they say in the booth, or it's some declining skills. I hope to believe it's the first, not the second, because again, these guys are in great shape. Jonathan Toews got himself in better shape in the offseason as well, and we're starting to see some goals from Brandon Saad. You can't waste those. You got to win those games.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And, you know, I have to say, even though they were 0-3 on the power play against Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
I did notice, like, a better rotation
yeah.
of the puck going
and
on.
The last one especially.
Which, you know, that I think is really a key thing.
Yeah.
But still, it's and I will tell you, I think it was a goalie game.
It was a goal again.
Their
guy was great.
And for his first ever start in the mm-hmm. NHL.
And he played collegially at Notre Dame. And they were talking about it in the broadcast that the last time he was in that building, he lost a regional game or something like that for Notre Dame. It was kind of vindication for him, but he was really good. Cal Peterson is the guy's name.
Right.
34 saves. And you know, you can't blame Corey Crawford for any of this. Corey Crawford has been dynamite since he's been back in the lineup. You know, but it's hard to sell a fan base that's used to winning championships on baby steps and moral-type victories, but I think you're right. With the power play, that showed some signs. It didn't connect on a goal, but as you pointed out, it showed some signs of actual structure.
Right.
And that's something to look forward to, perhaps, as early as tonight. Now, the Wild have been pretty hot, but, you know, anything can happen there on that home ice.
It would be nice to have a Chicago sweep of Minnesota teams tonight.
Yeah, one already happened because the Northwestern took care of Minnesota.
Well, correct, yes. Yeah,
so now we've got the Hawks and the Bears.
Now, that would be a very great Thanksgiving for me.
It would be a very happy Thanksgiving for a lot of people.
Now, have you guys got your Black Friday shopping plans done?
Yeah, I usually ignore it.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Really?
I used to make an afternoon out of it. That was when I had a very different work schedule. So I will be here for much of the morning on Black Friday.
So you can order online.
And
that's usually what I do.
You can do that. I may end up doing. I know I'm going to have to buy a couple of things online for between now and Christmas for some people. But I still do the bulk of my shopping in a store. But we'll take it as it comes on Black Friday. Once I'm done here, I'm not sure what will the afternoon will bring.
I always go to Chris Kindlemart.
Ah, okay.
Kind of to start the
season.
Going to
be very busy.
It always is, but that's part of it.
Oh, though. Yeah.
You know, that's... I guess they had like a preview party over there?
They had a preview party Thursday evening. They opened on
I didn't get
Friday.
My invite, you know.
Me neither. But they open Friday and will be there through Christmas Eve. They have a location once again in Naperville. This year,
very good.
In the old Napier settlement, yep. And one being set up in Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee,
yeah,
oh, wow.
Be in Milwaukee, so that's going on, and entertainment, of course, musical entertainment, especially on weekends.
You mean not just the people who show up
that's
to go
right.
visit it,
that's
which
right.
just provides its own kind
yeah,
of entertainment
musical
too.
Entertainment, yes, that's.
Yeah, well, they think they're musical, a lot of them too. I might add,
that's unintentional.
No, they have a real brass band that comes, and they are quite good. So,
oh yes,
they'll be around. Glenn Sorgartz, I believe, is the name of the band. So they'll be there. There's kids programs and the Glühwein.
Yes, I'll let you go with that.
I had to bring that up.
I know that's not my kind of cup of tea, as it were. I mean, a little of the I like the beers are kind of refreshing.
Ah, yes, and a Bitburger.
Do they have chili?
You might be able to find some chili.
You and your chili.
Chili and a brat. Doesn't that sound good?
I'm making some tonight.
You're making chili tonight?
Oh, yeah.
Good night for it. Watch the Bears.
Chili and Bears, yep.
I'm making a crock pot Italian beef.
Ooh.
For the Bears game tonight.
Okay. That's going to be nice and tender.
So that'll scrap my plans and come on over.
You're more than welcome.
Like I said, we can wait.
I got to, you know, obviously I'm going to have to get a nap in here because of the time adjustment with the flex game that they pulled on.
Right.
But that'll be nice because then I can just snooze while the crock pot is kind of
there. You go.
There. Let things waft through the air.
Indeed, indeed. See? And I started it before I came to the studio, so it should be even better.
By the time you get home.
Correct.
Yeah. A slow, slow cook.
You know?
Yep. Love it.
I can plan sometimes. Not often. But it's dangerous when I start planning, that's for sure. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy has the latest sports. Producer Cassara's in and fielding your phone calls. She's at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is asking for my jazzed up green bean casserole recipe, which we're going to post on our WGN radio website where you can find all of our shows. That's WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. 7:23 on this Sunday morning. This is your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Up ahead on the show today, after the 7:30 news, we'll speak to Christina Zahorek. She is the new chair of the Illinois Democratic County Chairs Association. She's also the McHenry County Democratic Chair and also the 14th District Democratic State Central Committee Woman. Lot to put on a business card. We'll talk to her about the Democratic successes on Election Day, the wins by women candidates, and what's next for Illinois under the blue wave that swept through on Election Day. After the 8 o'clock news, we'll speak to Carla Norowski. She is the CEO of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum Foundation. And we'll talk to her about museum funding issues surrounding that facility down in Springfield. After the 8:30 news, we'll speak to Susana Mendoza. And, of course, she's the recently reelected Democratic State Comptroller and is now officially a candidate for mayor of Chicago. We'll talk to her about her campaign agenda. That's coming up. Now it's time to launch our weekly spin through national politics. We begin with the heating rhetoric over President Trump's choice of Matthew Whitaker to serve as interim attorney general after Trump fired Jeff Sessions. Now, Democrats fear that Whitaker will shut down special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. And the talk even began a week ago last Sunday on ABC's This Week when incoming Democratic Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler told George Stephanopoulos there's a lot that committee Democrats can do.
And he should recuse himself because he has expressed total hostility. He's to the investigation. He has said the investigation shouldn't go forward. And someone who said that should not be in charge of deciding on the investigation.
So if Matt Whitaker is still the acting attorney general when you become chair of the Judiciary Committee...
We will make sure that Matt Whitaker immediately, one of the first orders of business will be to invite him, and if necessary, to subpoena him to appear... To appear before the committee.
So now, appearing before the committee, and will Whitaker be able to testify? That's another question. Nancy Pelosi, still kind of struggling in her effort to reclaim the speakership of the House, she went further in comments, directly accusing Trump of naming Whitaker to shut down Mueller.
The president continues to wage an all-out campaign to obstruct the Mueller investigation. Just this morning, the president once again took to Twitter to try to discredit the investigation, tweeting, "A total witch hunt like no other in American history." This is the president of the United States. President Trump installed Matthew Whitaker as acting AG for one purpose, to end the investigation.
That's Nancy Pelosi. Now, on the Senate floor, retiring Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona said he was joining in legislation with Democrats aimed at protecting Robert Mueller. He also said he would block Trump appointments to the judiciary.
I rise today to speak in defense of the special counsel, of Special Counsel Robert Mueller, and to defend the vital role he has played since May of last year in yet another act of service to his country in what has been a lifetime of distinguished service. For his trouble, Mr. Mueller has been accused repeatedly and without basis in fact of conducting a witch hunt in the course of his current investigation by none other than the President of the United States.
That's retiring Republican Senator Jeff Flake. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. 7:37 on this Sunday morning. You know, I just played some cuts with the issue of Robert Mueller and threats of whether the interim attorney general is going to shut down the Mueller investigation. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky was asked by reporters if he believed that protection legislation was needed in order to keep Mueller's investigation alive.
In the past, you've said that you don't think that legislation to protect the special counsel is necessary. Given what's happened over the past week, has your view changed?
No. I mean, there's been no indication, as you can imagine, I've talked to the president fairly often, no indication that the Mueller investigation will not be allowed to finish, and it should be allowed to finish. We know how the president feels about the Mueller investigation, but he's never said he wants to shut it down. I've never heard anybody down there say they want to shut it down. I think it's in no danger, and so I don't think any legislation is necessary.
So there you have it. That's coming from Mitch McConnell. Well, now, joining me on the show, as we switch to more local things, is Christine Zahorek. She is the head of the Illinois Democratic County Chairs Association, McHenry County Democratic Chair, 14th Congressional District Democratic State Central Committee Woman. Christine, thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So I mentioned about how with all of these titles, you've got a pretty full load here of business card duties here.
Yes, but that certainly is true. However, they are compatible, I think, titles and duties for sure.
Now, you became the new head of the Democratic County Chairs on November 10th after Doug House's tenure there. And, you know, obviously part of the Democratic County Chairs was to help operate the Blue Wave operation that was seeded by J.B. Pritzker. And, I mean, I would imagine it's for a lot of these counties, they had never really received any funding before to, you know, be able to put together a field operation.
Yes, and I think that, part of that effort was not so much candidate or campaign specific, but again, reaching across the state and actually building that county party structure in a real way, not just, again, looking at a specific campaign, but building that, going back and building that infrastructure and supporting county parties in doing what their jobs really should be. Building precinct committee persons, making sure you're appointing Democratic election judges, things of that nature.
And a lot of these, I mean, a lot of this were in counties where there really wasn't any kind of a structure to do that or had never.
Maybe not never, but also just wasn't as robust as we would like them to be.
And, I mean, as you look at Tuesday's results, I mean, what does that tell you about the party and about going forward?
I think that there's, I think that at least in terms of the county chairs association, that Doug has left a really good framework to continue to build on. And certainly I would say that Illinois did see a blue wave. However, that wave didn't necessarily reach all parts of the state. In certain parts of central and southern Illinois, there's been characterized a red tide, if you will. And I think that that's only part of the story, that in those counties, similar to McHenry, where up until this election cycle, perhaps we would have been characterized as more conservative, that there were still positive things that came out, in part due to that Blue Wave effort, where we narrowed the margins, or again, we started to build that infrastructure. I was speaking with a fellow county chair just the other day, and they didn't really have, if you looked at the numbers, they didn't have a lot of wins on the books.
Mm-hmm.
But what they did have is, again, narrowing that margin and starting to build on the ground people that have a real sense now on how to run campaigns or how to get out the vote that they didn't have before, that kind of structure, which is, again, I think, another measure of our success with that blue wave.
Now, I know, you know, with McHenry, that kind of is a county that's still kind of a reflection of a bit of the divide that exists between urban and rural, as it were. And, you know, obviously, when you look at what happened in the collar counties, which really was a replica of what happened in 2016 in the presidential, where the collar counties, all except McHenry, went Democratic for Hillary Clinton. And well, I mean, one of the things I think when as Democrats look, they look at how red the southern part of the state has gotten, and how red the more rural areas of the state has gotten. And I'm kind of curious, because you're kind of in that border area, you know, what do Democrats need to do in those areas to attract those? And a lot of those areas were Democratic at one time, deep south.
Yes, absolutely. And again, I think that's part of the challenge for the association, is reaching back out into those communities and having those conversations on values to find where there is commonality and mutual value issues, right? So, you know, years and years and years ago, I worked for Senator Simon out in D.C., and I remember he would tell us, you know, even if you're reaching across the aisle and working with folks that you think that perhaps you don't have any commonality with, you find it, even if it's something simple like the sky is blue and you can agree on that, right?
I'm not sure people can agree on the sky being blue anymore in this climate. Just have that feeling.
I don't know. I mean, I certainly have. I'm more optimistic. I think that you can. And being able to hear the concerns of fellow Illinoisans, where I think we had a governor previously who spent a lot of energy and effort trying to divide us, whether it was, you know, between the urban and the suburban, between the suburban and the rural, between central Illinois, southern Illinois, and the northern part. You know, I think that that kind of rhetoric hopefully is now gone and stopped, and we can understand that we all are Illinoisans and have similar desires and goals for our families and our future.
Well, I mean, I've always thought one of the greatest strengths of this state is the diversity that exists in this state, including the regional and geographic diversity. But again, in this kind of polarized atmosphere, I'm not sure there can be any kind of kumbaya moment. I mean, truly, you look at the 200th bicentennial of the state is December 3rd, and they had to move it to a smaller venue because they couldn't sell enough tickets. That almost, to me, is kind of a reflection of where Illinois is today.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that I look at it in a more optimistic...
See, that's the reporter in me. Yeah. I have to be, you know, the cynic, right?
But I think what's really wonderful about this last election is that you did have such a diverse engagement of people that had never come out or participated in elections the way that they had this time. We had, in particular, women coming out and engaging and in stepping out of their comfort zone like never before. You know, I think about my own county and some of the women who, again, other than a civic lesson years ago in their life when they were in school, had never really engaged. They might have voted, although perhaps not consistently in elections, but really kind of coming out of the woodwork, stepping up and wanting to engage in ways that really tested their comfort level. I have a woman in particular that I'm thinking of who, you know, first kind of came out and said, you know, what can I do? How can I be helpful? Right? I want to engage. Never knocked a door in her life, never made a phone call that was political in her life. And, you know, ended up not only knocking doors and making phone calls, organizing her neighborhood, and her cul-de-sac, and going on to being a poll watcher. I mean, it was just really kind of incredible to me because, again, she was indicative of a lot of folks, a lot of women, in this past election cycle that we're stepping up and really engaging.
We're speaking with Christina Zahorek. She is the new head of the Illinois Democratic County Chairs Association. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. On this Sunday morning, I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. This is your Sunday Spin. We're speaking with Christina Zahorek. She is head of the Illinois Democratic County Chairs Association. She's also the McHenry County Democratic Chair. And Christina, before the break, we were talking about, you know, just what a wave of women voters there were and women candidates that were successful in this election. And I guess, you know, is this a one-time thing?
No.
Well, and how does somebody in your position keep it from being a one-time thing?
Yeah, I certainly hope not. And you know, part of my goal is to make sure that we continue to engage women and those pop-up organizations that kind of came out to do that civic engagement, and not only just women, but certainly women of color as well. To give them agency and voice in the process where perhaps they didn't before or didn't understand or know that they could have agency, right? Because, again, I think that what we saw certainly in, for example, in the 14th congressional.
With
correct, which is, you know, my state hat, state party hat. We did see really kind of an amazing coalition that was created in part, you know, around this concern and eventually, I think, anger about a elected official who did not represent and or was unwilling to engage with his electorate. So I think that I do believe that a lot of those women that stepped up to engage on that level are going to stay engaged. And if they weren't candidates this time, I think that they very well may be candidates this next cycle, whether that's at the municipal level, whether that's at the school board level, or at the township level, or even higher up as we move forward to 2020.
And the 14th Congressional District, of course, is where Democrat Lauren Underwood defeated her Republican incumbent there. And, of course, a lot of that, too, was health care, which seemed to be a kind of a galvanizing issue for women in both campaigns and for getting out the vote.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, obviously that's an issue that touches everyone. And, you know, I also believe that for women in particular, you know, we often fulfill a couple of different roles on that issue. Not only are we ourselves users of health care, but we often provide that health care, right? Or we see it on a couple of levels, particularly these, you know, a lot of the women that we were talking about are coming out of a certain age, not only are concerned about their own health care, perhaps, but more so, I think, are concerned about their loved ones, whether it's their parents, whether it's their spouses or their children.
We have a call from Ron. Ron, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yes, good morning, Rick, to your guests. I'd like to ask you to address a concern as far as citizens like myself about the total concentration. You speak about the blue wave, but if you look at all the top elected positions held by Democrats. So I just think democracy works better when there is some separation of power. We look at the power of Mike Madigan, Howard Pritzker. So yeah, maybe you can just address that concern as a citizen of the state. I really have some concerns about that. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron. Christina?
I'm sorry, was the concern that
The Democrats have too much power in the state now that they have all of the statewide offices, they've got supermajorities in the legislature. How do you address the issue of whether Democrats have, there's too much concentration of power in this state?
We often talk about Democrats as being a big tent with a variety of viewpoints under that tent. And often it is, you know, we talk about Democrats as being difficult, as if we're herding a bunch of cats, right? So my response, I think, is that while I understand the caller's concern, I do believe that when we look at everything that our previous governor did to this state in terms of damaging our state, I think that is imperative that we have the Democrats that we have elected or needed in order to put the state back on the right path and moving us forward in a positive direction for all of our citizens here in Illinois.
And, of course, obviously, with power comes the need to perform.
Correct.
And
I thought you were going to quote Spider-Man.
That you will never hear from me is quoting.
Great responsibility.
Well, but it's true.
Which is absolutely
the late Stan Lee. Yes, but yeah. I mean, it now. I mean, the onus is truly on the party to produce results.
It is, and I think there's a willingness, though, among the powers that be to do that.
Is that your optimism? I
mean, I'm sorry?
Is that your optimism? No,
no,
I just mean...
I think it's also true. I think there is a expressed willingness to move our state in the right direction and put us back on the right track.
That's
we were there prior to Browner. And I think that there is a willingness amongst all of those who are elected to continue on that path now that he's no longer there.
That's Christina Zahorek. She's head of the Illinois Democratic County Chairs Association. Thank you so much for joining me. And I know we'll be talking a lot as we progress to future elections.
And thank you so much for having me, Rick.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. There are more Republicans speaking out against President Trump's criticism of GOP congressional losses and blaming it on their failure to embrace him. Illinois Republican Representative Adam Kinzinger was on CNN.
I was disgusted when I heard it happen. I mean, these are members that in their districts are reflecting their district. Some of them lost because people were frankly voting against the president. And I think if the president would have shown some more grace in that and said, you know, we're going to miss them, but thank you for their service, instead of it's because you didn't back me. And I can tell you a lot of these folks, Mia Love backed the president a lot. And that may have cost her if she ends up losing. I know it's still open. So a little more grace would have been a lot better. I was very disgusted when I heard that. And I'm like, well, let's go forward and look at how we're going to do better in 2020.
In fact, some late counts show that Mia Love has moved ahead of her Democratic challenger, even though the president declared her one of the losers that failed to embrace him. We're also getting some final concessions going on in some still undecided races. Andrew Gillum conceded in the race for Florida governor to Republican Ron DeSantis. And in Georgia, Democrat Stacey Abrams conceded her bid to become the state's first black woman chief executive, but she urged her followers not to be angry.
Now, in response, you may seek to vent your anger, or worse, to turn away from politics, because it can be as rotten and rigged as you've always believed. But I implore each of you not to give in to that anger or apathy, but instead turn to action. Because the antidote to injustice is progress. The cure to this malpractice is a fight for fairness in every election held, in every law passed, in every decision made.
That's Democrat Stacey Abrams in Georgia conceding her race for governor. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Carla Nowrowski. She is CEO of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation. Carla, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for the invitation.
Want to talk to you about a fiscal issue involving the foundation, a collection that it purchased, a loan that needs to be paid back, the possibility of Lincoln-connected artifacts having to be sold off. Can you just take us through a history of this to where we are right now?
Sure. This collection is a collection of about 1,500 pieces of Lincoln-related artifacts. It was, at the time, the largest privately held collection in the world. In 2007, we were asked by the state of Illinois, specifically the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency, the director of the museum and library, and the state historian, to purchase the collection on their behalf. At the time, the museum and library felt that they were very strong on primary source documents, like having a copy of the Gettysburg Address, the Emancipation, and the 13th Amendment, but not so strong on Abraham Lincoln's personal effects. So they were only 2 years old. They asked us to purchase the collection. We were only 7 years old, so we took out financing. Over the course of the loan, we have paid back more than $13 million towards principal, $8 million in interest, and we also got $2 million of those artifacts donated in kind. It was a $25 million. It is a $25 million collection. So we've been vigorously working to pay off that loan. It's been, as I said, since 2007, and the note is due in October of 2019. And so we're hoping to raise the remainder from private philanthropists. We've had almost 2,300 people privately donate to this in the course of our fundraising, and we're hoping that the state will come and either match a portion of that to close out the loan so we can meet the obligation by October of 2019.
Now, I know there was a two-hour or so hearing that was held in Springfield this past week to talk about the possibility of the state taking over the debt and repaying the debt. But there also seem to be concerns, and bipartisan concerns, of wanting more transparency, to the point of even Representative Tim Butler from Springfield talking about wanting to have the Auditor General, Frank Montino, basically audit the books of the foundation. Is that an acceptable trade-off for the state to taking over the loan and paying it off?
If that's what is required, yes. I mean, we have, in our 18-year history, we have always complied with all rules and regulations that are required by us by state and federal government. We have had 18 years of audits and never had an audit finding. We publish our 990s. We publish our annual report. We've done everything that we're supposed to do. The museum and library director has always been an ad hoc member of our board so that he or she, over the course of history, has been able to hear what's been going on. So, yes.
Is there a problem of the foundation in essence being separate from the museum?
No, this is a traditional model, particularly with state entities, with private foundations that serve state entities. There are 12 public universities in the state. They have private foundations. The governor's mansion has a private foundation. So this is not a strange model. It actually is one that has been in place for quite some time.
But I mean, it seems to be that that's where some of this tension also comes from, is this kind of that separation issue.
Yes, and I'm not exactly sure why that is, because this is a model that works. Early on, the leadership was all under, I guess, one roof, so to speak, and it was determined that it was better to separate it out so that the private arm of this is the fundraising arm, and then the public arm is the day-to-day operations of the museum and library.
We're speaking with Carla Nowrowski. She is CEO of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio, where I'm joined by Carla Nowrowski. She is the CEO of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation. And Dave, I know you had a question from the newsroom.
Well, in view of the fact that we have such a treasure in Springfield with all of the Lincoln artifacts and the home and the library itself, which is a wonderful thing to see, and the fact that you're coming up into these money problems here, and in fact maybe auctioning off some of these items, it must be a hard choice to decide what might be up for auction and what will stay. Is there a process, a decision-making process involved with something like this?
Yes. Well, first I want to say that it is not our intention at all. I mean, this is not what we would prefer to do. We
right.
do not
oh,
want
exactly.
to have to auction.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we have conferred with the executive director of the museum and library, as well as the state historian. They put together a list of, if they had to do something, you know, what might go first. But in the end, an auction house will be the ones who determine what would be sellable in order to meet the remainder of the debt.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So where do things stand? I mean, what if the legislature says, well, we'll give you $3 million? I mean, where do things stand as far as fundraising and trying to make up for the money?
We are still vigorously fundraising. We have several seven-figure asks out, large seven-figure asks. Although saying that, even small gifts help us. And by December 31st, we will have had to select an auction house. We sent out an RFI requesting information from auction houses, and we've gotten several back. We're in the process of reviewing those. We auctioned off a few non-core items that were not specific to Lincoln back in June, and that process door-to-door was a 10-month process, so we really have our backs to the wall on this. And I'd like to say, you know, there's some people who mischaracterize this as a bailout. This is not a bailout. The state asked us to purchase this, and at the time, we all worked together knowing that this would be a debt that we would all have to work to close. There are universities and other state institutions across this state that receive state funds. They might receive $40 million to build a molecular biology building, and a private donor will come in and give $5 million and get their name on the building, and everyone celebrates a great public private partnership. We have raised $21 million for this collection, and I don't think it should be categorized as a bailout. What it is, it should be, is a public-private partnership for a great capital project.
Is it hard to sell Lincoln? Should this have gotten to this point? Is it that hard to sell Lincoln in the state of Illinois?
You would think it wouldn't be hard, but one of the difficulties, like anything, is that when you have unfettered use, which the state has had for 11 years, if you have unfettered use of the collection, you can receive the licensing fees off it. You can loan it out to other institutions. People look at it like you've already got it. I only want to give money to something that you want. And even though we explain that, well, we have it under roof, but it really isn't totally ours, they still say, well, no, if you have use of it, it psychologically to them, it feels like you've got it. Also, the number one difficult thing to raise money for is debt. Usually in fundraising circles, people will say endowment, because usually debt isn't even part of the equation. But, you know, people just don't want to give to that. The other thing is that people often say to us, what's the state doing? And when we say, well, they're very generous about giving an $11 million budget to the museum and library, they say, no, we mean about the collection. If the state is not willing to give money for this collection, then do they really want it? And if they don't want it, why should we give? So this is the conundrum. You know, Lincoln's name alone is not enough to get people to release their hard-earned dollars.
Throughout the hearing that was in Springfield was the issue of questions about transparency. And we talked about the audit and that thing, but also there's questions about just greater transparency, FOIA, all those kinds of things. Is that an acceptable part of the equation for getting state assistance?
Well, what we would say about that is, as a private nonprofit, we're currently, as everyone says, we're currently not subject to that. Neither are the 12 state universities. I mean, if there's going to be an even hand across the board about it, you know, I think that's fair. I mean, we'll do whatever the law requires. We've always said that. We've always done that.
So why is there this demand from legislators for greater transparency, in their words?
There seems to be a misunderstanding about a report that we had issued or requested, I should say. And it's an independent report about the collection, specifically the hat. And when we issued it, we let the museum director and the agency director know that we were going to do this. Then when we received the results of the committee report, we let them know in real time what the results were. They found out when our board found out. And this was several years ago, before the current museum and library director came on board. And yet people keep saying there was no disclosure, there was no disclosure. There was disclosure, and in fact, I did disclose this to the library museum director in January. I didn't hand him the report, but I told him of the existence of the report.
Is the report available now?
Yes, he has a copy of it.
I mean, is it publicly available?
Yes, people have seen it, yes.
So what is next? What's the next step here?
Well, we're continuing to fundraise. We're also working with the legislature to see if we could get some state funds. A commitment, hopefully, either by the end of the year or in the spring session. We will also be interviewing auction houses. We have to do this simultaneously to keep our everything going on all fronts, depending upon which way things fall out. So we will continue to fundraise. We will continue to seek funds from the state, and we will continue to review the auction RFI so that if we have to go to auction, we're prepared.
Well, something we'll all be keeping an eye on. Carla Nowrowski from the CEO of the Abraham Lincoln Library Presidential Foundation, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back with more right after this.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Last week, Jeff Flake, the retiring Republican senator, he spoke at the Radio Television Correspondents' Dinner, where he touched on CNN's Jim Acosta, who had his White House hard pass revoked until it was restored by a judge. Here's Jeff Flake.
Any of those who have spent time in public life have endured news coverage that we felt was jaded or unfair. But in our positions, to employ even idle threats, to use laws or regulations to stifle criticism, or to take away credentials, is corrosive to our democratic institutions. Simply put, it is the press's obligation to uncover the truth about power. It is the people's right to criticize their government, and it is our job as politicians to take it.
That's retiring Republican U.S. Senator Jeff Flake. Well, we're going to bring things from Washington now down to the city level. Joining me on the phone is Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza, who is now Chicago mayoral candidate Susana Mendoza. Thank you so much for joining me this morning, Madam Comptroller.
Good morning.
So now that you're in the race, one quick question is, tomorrow is the first day of filing for candidates for mayor of Chicago at 9 a.m. Are you filing on the first day or the last day?
Well, we will not be filing on the first day. As you know, we got a little bit of a later start than the other candidates. But you know what? I don't think I've ever filed on the first day of filing for any race that I've been in, other than when I ran for state rep many, many years ago. So, no, it was never our intention to file on the first day, but we're looking forward to filing, so I'll put it to you that way.
So are you still soliciting signatures? Or?
We're still soliciting signatures, and it's usually what we do in any race that I've been in. I bet you there'll be a few people that filed tomorrow, but I'd be surprised if the bulk of them did. Even those who've been collecting for much longer than I have.
So I know that when you announced officially for mayor, obviously there was criticism about running for one office and then winning and now another. Same could probably be said for Tony Preckwinkle and the county board race as well. But is there a concern, a valid concern among voters that, you know, we elected you to a four-year term and now you're turning around and looking at mayor?
Look, number one, I totally love my job as controller, and I think, you know, everyone in the city was completely shocked by the mayor's announcement that he was leaving, especially about a month and a half before the election or so. So it's more of an issue of a calendar thing. I, of course, even though I absolutely love my job, I had said from pretty much the get-go that if Bruce Rauner had gotten reelected, that I would not, under any circumstances, consider running for mayor, because I have served as the last line of defense to Governor Rauner over the last 2 years, I should say for the people, against Governor Rauner. And there's no way I would have run for mayor if he had gotten reelected. But the fact of the matter is that he did not get reelected, and that means that Governor Rauner is now part of the past, and that's a good thing for Illinois. And I believe that the bigger challenge where I could be of most use not just to the people of Chicago, but also to the people of Illinois, is by running for the mayor of Chicago. And that's what I'm focused on right now in terms of election-wise, but I'm still the controller in the very same vein that the president is still the president of Cook County. And you know, we can do both right now. And most importantly, the bigger challenge is what's going to happen, not just in the next 4 years in Chicago, but what is going to happen to the future and the next generation of Chicago.
So when you look at this wide field that's out there, and obviously you do have some name recognition, just even off this last election, but as having served in the legislature prior to that. But what do you have to really do, or what do you think you have to do to really distinguish yourself in such a vast field of candidates?
Look, I'm not worried about the field of candidates because I don't consider myself running against the field. I'm running for Chicago, and I'm very passionate about that. So, like in any race that I've ever run, certainly I've run citywide before, twice as city clerk, and my goal and my passion is connecting with all Chicagoans in every single neighborhood. And so that's what I'm going to focus on. Everyone else is going to have a different way that they handle their race. I'm not concerned about that. I'm concerned about making sure that every Chicagoan knows that I am fully committed to being a mayor that, first of all, is from a neighborhood that understands neighborhoods and that's going to put neighborhoods first. My story is very similar to the one of many Chicagoans, and the issues that Chicagoans care about, issues like violence, needing to improve schools, and property taxes being something that many people feel suffocated by, those are my very same issues. My husband and I live them. We have a 6-year-old little boy who you always hear me talk about. And, you know, we're so excited. Well, he's actually going to be 6 in a couple weeks, but he started kindergarten already, had his first report card, lost his first tooth, and the same stuff so many parents go through, but he is in the CPS system. He's going to a little neighborhood school, CPS school, right here where we live, and he's going to be in that system, and we're going to be parents, CPS parents, for the next 13 years. So we're very committed to improving our school system, as well as making sure that every child can walk to school and get back home safely to their parents and not be scared to walk to school. I remember what it was like to be 7 years old and afraid to walk to school. And as much as I love to learn, I couldn't really focus on that entirely because I was thinking about the walk home. And unfortunately, that's still the case today with many kids in many neighborhoods of Chicago, and I want to be the mayor that changes that.
Well, let's talk about CPS. Obviously, there's still issues involving some schools that are underutilized. There are issues about the school closing moratorium ending. Where do you see us going forward when it comes to CPS in the schools?
Well, I think there's a lot that we have to do. I mean, obviously, I believe that that schools aren't just brick-and-mortar buildings. They're the heart of the neighborhoods. And, you know, if you could make the case, even if you could, for closing or consolidating a school, it needs to be done in collaboration with the people impacted by those schools. So you're talking about the parents, the teachers, even the children, because, like I said, they're not just bricks-and-mortar. The concept of a community school program is really something that I'm very passionate about, and that means, you know, children getting not just, going to school for learning, which, of course, is the principal thing, but our kids get school breakfast, which is something that I championed in the legislature. Before I was a state rep and passed that bill, kids in poverty, kids in schools that had 40% or more of their enrollment eligible for free or reduced lunch, they did not get school breakfast. I got that bill passed, and I'm super excited to have done that. But it's important that kids, you know, are able to learn because they're not hungry. Their little bellies aren't grumbling all day. So we give them school breakfast. You could give kids lunch like they do today, but also supper, you know, because there are some communities where those schools, once those kids get there, that's the safety anchor for them as well. And while, can you imagine a scenario where kids are getting breakfast, lunch, supper, and meanwhile their parents are getting access to social services and learning job skills, how to hold on to a job. Hold on one second. You're going to crack up about this, but my kid just turned the TV on. David, heck, mommy, have me.
That's all right.
Okay, let's stop up.
Well, Susanna, we'll switch off here. We'll take a quick break. So you're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. And joining me on the phone is Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza, a candidate for mayor of Chicago. And, Madam Comptroller, we're talking about Chicago public schools. And I know you support a elected school board in Chicago, which has been a very contentious issue down in Springfield. What's your rationale for supporting it when others say that that actually could be a way that could give too much power to the Chicago Teachers Union?
I think that it's more democratic, Rick, and I think that parents should have a stake in, or a bigger voice in what's happening in their school system. And I intend to be one of those voices as a mother of a CPS student, and across the board, it shouldn't just be the mayor that's making these decisions. And that's why I think it's a good thing. Democracy is a good thing. I don't really fear it. And I do think that it will make for a better partnership moving forward. We've got to try different things when it comes to improving our schools, and I think parents have the biggest stake in what's going on in their school system.
You mentioned earlier about the issue of property taxes, and I think, property taxes are always the most hated tax. But it seems like now, because of issues like pensions, it's really reaching a point that something's got to be done about that. Where do we go next as far as alternative funding mechanisms that can relieve some of the pressure on property taxes?
Right. Well, the good news is that we have a new governor now, and JB has talked about moving forward with the progressive income tax. And even while we don't have a progressive income tax in place yet, because it's probably going to take a couple of years, he's looking to implement progressivity in our current tax structure through, different types of perhaps tax credits for the middle and lower class and things of that nature. Having said that, having a fair tax in place is going to bring in new revenues. And the thing is that, people forget that the municipalities have to increase property taxes, or they've had to in the past, because Springfield just doesn't do its fair share of sending money back to those municipalities. It doesn't pay enough into our education system, which is in large part why municipalities have to keep going back to their local taxing bodies and increasing property taxes. But people feel taxed out. Now, any new revenues that come in through the state, be it through casinos or fair tax, in other words, the progressive income tax, or any other type of revenues. I know they're talking about marijuana legalization as well. Revenues that get raised through that should be coming. Obviously not all of them. They have to be spread across the state, but Chicago needs to make sure that they're getting their fair share. That in and of itself is not going to solve, a pension crisis, or, keep in mind we're going to be looking potentially at a recession coming in the next few years. But, I think that the next mayor is going to have to look at all of the potential revenue streams that might be coming to the state and that we could be getting revenues from, but also look at all the financial tools available. Remember, I've been leading the state through the worst fiscal crisis in its history over the last 2 years. So I think if there's any candidate who's already been in the hot seat when it comes to the finances and been able to move things along and make a fiscal condition better, in my case for the state, it's been me. And so I walked into the scariest of fiscal situations for the state of Illinois under the worst conditions with a governor who actually made our finances worse and had to be that last line of defense. And remember, I'm the one who championed the bonding deal that allowed us to save $4 to $6 billion because we refinanced a 12% debt to a 3.5%. So I'm going to look at all the tools that we have available. Once I'm mayor and I can pull the curtain back and see what our finances and our options really look like. But, financial challenges are difficult challenges, but they're math. You've got to figure it out. Whereas some of our other challenges are greater. Again, the need to improve our schools. How are we going to go about doing that? How are we going to make conditions where children can just feel safe walking back to school, something that is a day in and day out situation for Chicagoans? I think it's really time to have a mayor that certainly understands finances and how to tackle them, but most importantly, a mayor who is really from the neighborhoods, who understands neighborhoods, and who's going to be putting neighborhoods first in that formula.
Has JB said to you that a new progressive tax structure, how that cities would share a greater amount of that take from the state?
Well, I would certainly, as mayor, push for Chicago getting its fair share. And that's the other thing. You know, I mean, we've never really had a mayor that navigates their way around Springfield as well as I do. And that's an area that's a sweet spot for me. I understand it. I was a former legislator for 10 years. I know how the finances of the state run. And you better be sure that as mayor, I'm going to be demanding that we get our fair share for the city. And every mayor should be doing that for their own municipality. But I'll be doing that for Chicago.
But, I mean, as you know, mayoral visits to Springfield are somewhat rare and more kind of ceremonial than real work getting done.
That's not how mine will be. I mean, that's maybe how other mayors have done it, but other mayors haven't really had very deep relationships or knowledge of how Springfield works. I do. I'll probably be the first mayor that the city has ever had that understands Springfield inside and out, because I've worked there and I've been not just, you know, a ceremonial legislator. I mean, I'm somebody who knows how to navigate the legislative system. And I mean, just look at what we did this year in the controller's office. We managed to pass the largest transparency reform in the history of the state of Illinois, along with four other transparency reforms, a super aggressive agenda that really shines light on the state's finances, which is really important for people, that they know how their tax dollars are being spent. And I did that in the most toxic of political environments with Governor Rauner working against me, yet managed to pass my entire agenda with unanimous or near unanimous support. And that means that I know how to work with Democrats and Republicans. I know how to work with anyone and everyone to get things done. That's the kind of mayor that Chicago is going to need. And there's no learning curve for me on how to get things done in Springfield that benefit the city of Chicago.
That's Susana Mendoza, the Democratic State Comptroller and candidate for mayor of Chicago. Thank you, Madam Comptroller, for joining me this morning.
Hey, thanks. And sorry about that little, what do you call it, that little interruption. But, hey, that's what being a mom is all about, right? And Saturday, or is it Sunday? I don't even know what day
it is. It's Sunday. It's Sunday.
Sundays are the best, my friend. I got to go to church. All right.
Thank you.